From the Land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 19th day of November, 2021. It's National Farm City Week. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Suslow. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Eric Snodgrass will be here to discuss the weather forecast, and along the way, we'll explore industrial hemp in the state of Illinois and how producers can transition to it and what that means for rural Americans and urban Americans alike. All on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It comes to you from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
I'm out of the office on this Friday, so Mike Suslow and I are talking earlier in the day. Hi, Mike. Thank you for joining me on what is a pretty darn cool Friday, I think, in terms of temperature across a lot of the Midwest. How are things there in Atchison, Kansas?
Doing well. We've cooled down as well. A lot of field work has gotten done, though, here, Todd. I've been surprised at how much wetter your part of the Corn Belt has been versus ours. In fact, I just talked to a client earlier, and he said he's about an hour north of me, and he said that he has never been in such a position as far as having all of his fall field work and needs covered. And he said, I'm going to be pretty fast at it in the springtime. So something to keep in mind as we get closer to the springtime and as we see what Mother Nature has for us around planting, if we have a very fast planting in this part of the country or not.
Does he generally apply anhydrous ammonia for corn in the fall, or does he do that in the spring? Do you know?
Typically spring, yeah. Yeah, typically
so still
spring.
Waiting on that, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly right. That might be part of it.
Yeah, speaking of which then, producers have been worried about anhydrous ammonia, natural gas, crude oil, all those sorts of things that are related to the inflation in the economy at this point. I'm wondering if you've been thinking very much about inflation as it relates to commodities, in fact.
No, only about 12 hours a day. Yeah, I think that's probably what all of us are thinking about. And I think this is where, you know, if you look at the market right now, as we go into the end of the week, we saw a flat line and we saw some pushback by the sellers. We had some profit taking by the longs and the sellers came in. And I think it probably is indicative of both this week's trade. And as we go forward, the market's trying to figure out where they are in the inflation cycle. They have a pretty good grasp. The Federal Reserve has been caught on the wrong side of the inflation, and how fast the Fed moves next month is going to be a big question mark. But in the more short term, I think given the fact that policymakers are more active trying to free up crude oil, whether it's here in China or in the United States, shipping rates have dropped. End users have probably picked up a little bit extra supply now in the grains, if you especially look at the Middle East and what's happening in the wheat purchases that we've seen from countries out there that typically don't, you know, buy more than hand to mouth. So I think the market, maybe especially after the export sales Thursday, is wondering whether they've taken prices high enough for now to ration the demand. And I think that has to be thought about in the context that European wheat did hit a 14-year high here to this week. And so we're up there at 2007 levels right now in the European wheat market.
Enough rationing may be taking place in lots of places, or at least that's what I think you just told me. Does that mean we need to turn the market lower, or is this a sideways to higher, just sideways market? What are your expectations?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because that's only one half the side of the equation. And I think, you know, with the European Union looking at more lockdowns because of COVID, we know Austria is going to go lockdown. We think that Germany is going to go lockdown probably this weekend, early next week. And it really opens up the idea that the whole European Union could. On top of that, we have heard now that Russia's got a new daily record for deaths due to COVID. So the demand side does look weaker than it did 30 days or 60 days ago. And in fact, I went back to September 30th and looked at the prices for all the major commodities. And not surprisingly, we've got the wheat up 13%, corn's up almost 7%, and the beans are about flat. So the market's doing what it should, I think, Todd. I think to answer your question more specifically, though, we still have supply out there. We still have Canada weather, the flooding there. We have Australian weather, the flooding there. We have the lysine shortage. The number one winner in the price action for futures since September 30th close has been the soy meal, up 14% going into Friday's trade. And that has to do with supply shortages of lysine. And then we still have the U.S. corn and bean yield to contend with. So I'm thinking very high volatility, a lot of spinning of wheels at this point, heading into the holidays, thinner trade. But we don't lose too much unless something really big happens, and that's where the dollar comes in.
A thinner trade oftentimes means a lot of volatility. We watch that in the overnight trade every night, it seems, sometimes, because there's so little trade that happens, but moves can be pretty rapid and far in the overnight trade compared to the day trade. But volatility could be interesting between now and the end of the year, I guess.
Yes, and I think we're also going to see a generational push here in terms of volatility push as well, because I think the younger generation, the 20-year-old people, 25, 30-year-old people who are used to trading Bitcoin are looking more and more at the commodities now because inflation's out of the bag, and they are very instant gratification people, so they take profit when they want to, and they don't hold or stick around for a loss, and so I think that's going to add an extra element of volatility. I think you're 100% right.
Is it volatility both ways? I mean, up and down?
Yeah, I think it will be. I really do, because we can't get rid of COVID. If we could shake COVID, I think then the downside would be more limited until we secured supply. But, you know, if we continue with COVID into February and all of a sudden we don't have any weather plays in South America, I think those beans especially have some real downside, because we'll probably have factored in the lysine shortage and clipped the demand in the meal as much as we can.
Does it mean you think farmers might want to have cash sale orders in above the market, where they think they're comfortable with, waiting for that volatility? And how do they deal with it, when they take a position in the market itself? Are you using options, or are you in the market with contracts?
Yeah, I think generally speaking, if the margin calls can be taken into consideration and you feel like you have a very deep pocket, then you can look at the futures. You know, I can't really make specific recommendations on air, but I think the big thing to watch out for is working the mindset that maybe the basis will not be as favorable in 2022 without some serious weather issues, because we may come back around and replenish, especially oilseed supplies. So I started 2022 hedging this week in beans. I've done a little bit more on the wheat, up to about a third sold in 22 wheat at this stage, and started the first 20% in 22 beans, and moved a little bit more of the 21 beans, and up around 80-85% now sold in the beans at this point, looking for more corn upside to be able to get some more corn sales in place.
For the livestock sector, anything you've been thinking about with them, particularly, I suppose, with the bean meal?
Yes, I think that's one of the things where we've lost the pork and bean trade with the funds. Again, maybe indicative of the market, maybe more worried about the emerging markets, more worried about China in 2022. We're not seeing the beans and hogs go up and down together. I think the biggest thing probably in the short term, Todd, is the cattle and feed report coming out later today. It's going to be a big one, because if we have big placements and low marketings, then USDA's commercial beef production numbers for Q2 and Q3 are probably too low, and it really is going to put more pounds out there of market-ready cattle, because we've been placing very heavy cattle out west. So if we see a bigger placements number like 102 plus and we can't get above 96 in marketings, and those are the average trade guesses, then we'll go over 12 million head on feed, probably keep the market well supplied, especially if we're slowing down on the demand side and the export front. So stay hedged in Q1, Q2 if we don't get a good cattle on feed report.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And we will talk to you not next week, because it's the holiday, but the following week.
That sounds great. Have a blessed Thanksgiving, and all the listeners out there, too.
That's Mike Zuzulo with GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Joined us here on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Up next, it's November the 19th, the day that President Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address. Here's my reading.
47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we're engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives, that nation might live. It's altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
I'm Todd Gleason. It's National Farm City Week from now through Thanksgiving. University of Illinois Extension is celebrating the link between rural and urban areas. Today, we'll explore industrial hemp production in the state with University of Illinois Extension commercial agriculture educator Philip Alberti. Now, up front, he is very clear that there is a difference between industrial hemp and marijuana.
Industrial hemp is the cannabis sativa plant. Both marijuana and hemp belong to the cannabis genus, yet industrial hemp is defined as the strains or varieties of cannabis that contain less than 0.3% THC. So real simply, if a cannabis plant contains below 0.3% THC, it's considered hemp. If it's above that 0.3% threshold, it's considered marijuana. I like to think of it as the difference between field corn and sweet corn. They're the same plant that have been bred for different purposes.
So you know there are a few types of hemp that can be grown, I guess. What are they and what are they used for?
Hemp can be grown for three things primarily. That's grain, fiber, and cannabinoids. Hemp can be used to make a variety of commercial industrial products, including rope and textiles, for clothing, food, paper, and biofuels. Primarily, the bast fibers can be used to make textiles and woven fabrics for clothing and furnishing, while the inner two fibers of the plant are typically woodier and have industrial applications such as mulch, animal bedding, and litter. Meanwhile, hemp grain or seeds are highly nutritious and are used to make hemp seed oil or hemp hearts, which can be found in the health food section of your local grocery store. But current areas of research are aimed at assessing hemp grain as an additive for animal feed, which has shown potential and could have huge implications in states like Illinois. And then lastly, hemp can be grown for cannabinoids. This is things like CBD or cannabidiol, which have been advertised to have potential health benefits, but the jury is still out on those, on what these molecules do and how they can actually be used properly. There are hundreds of cannabinoids out there, and we are just scratching the surface about them, and that's the safest thing I can say about the benefits of cannabinoids.
So what types of machinery are required to grow industrial hemp? And by the way, what about processing it?
So great questions. For grain and fiber, most materials and equipment are common to other farming methods, yet some settings or adaptations are needed to apply to hemp. For example, hemp is a very small seeded crop, so modifying planters using modified discs may be needed if not using a grain drill for planting. The grain needs to be harvested via combine, and the fiber is chopped and baled prior to processing. So this is very similar to our typical row crop production practices for grains or forages and hay. However, high cannabinoid hemp is unique in the sense that it's cultivated in many ways common to specialty crops. By that, I mean to say it's growing hemp for cannabinoids is often more specialized with the equipment and requires extensive labor throughout the season and especially at harvest. So that's one of the big differences there. In any case, no pesticides, herbicides, or insecticides can be used on hemp in Illinois. So weed management and disease control are going to be important to be successful no matter the type of hemp that you're growing. Processing is extremely limited right now, but there is going to be different processing depending on the type of hemp you're growing and the end product that it's going to be used for.
What things do I need to know to grow industrial hemp?
Growers, first things they're going to need to know is that they're going to need to have a license, and that's going to be issued through the Department of Agriculture. Growing hemp and processing hemp is subject to a wide range of rules and regulations, so interested parties really need to take an understanding of them prior to getting involved with hemp. You know, this is something that's not typically required in other row crops. For example, hemp growers are required to grow cannabis that tests below 3.3% THC, and you're going to be subject to random testing in the state of Illinois to ensure that you're following those rules. In addition to compliance testing, you know, various acreage requirements and pre-harvest notifications to the Department of Agriculture are going to be necessary. So there's a lot of new things growers or processors who are interested are going to have to know.
What are the biggest challenges with hemp production?
Well, the challenges with hemp are wide ranging, and it depends on the type of hemp that you're growing. But processing, or a lack thereof, is currently the biggest challenge across all three hemp production systems. As this is a new crop to the region, processing hubs and supply chains have yet to be developed. And additionally, best management practices and variety recommendations are still being developed as we learn more about this new crop option. In essence, we're learning as we go while the industry is being developed, while rules and regulations are changing, making production a risky decision for those for the time being.
What types of research projects are being conducted at the U of I on hemp, and why are they important, do you suppose?
We have a lot of interesting trials that we're conducting here at the university, the first of which is the variety trials and best management practice trials that we're conducting for grain, fiber, and cannabinoids. We really want to look at which production practices are working the best, which varieties are growing best and suited to this region, and what's the impact of those practices on post-harvest quality. You know, which varieties are going to produce the best quality materials for their intended purpose, whether that is for grain or textiles or for cannabinoids. So there's just a lot that we're learning with regards to that. Also, researchers on campus are developing a hemp breeding program to hopefully develop varieties which are best suited to Illinois growing conditions while producing a useful end product. The unique thing about that is we were able to collect feral hemp populations across the state the last few years. We're planting them out and getting to evaluate the genetics, some of these wild hemp populations that have been established for many, many years, going back to World War II and even before. So we're kind of using nature's adaptations to develop these better quality plants. And the last thing I want to discuss is some of the research projects that we're conducting with the Midwestern Hemp Database and assessing laboratory proficiency. So right now, there's not a lot of standards for laboratory analysis of these molecules. And so we're working with various private labs across the region to assess how these molecules are being analyzed to better understand differences across the analytical methods that are being used and make it easier for regulators, easier for growers to understand the results of their lab reports. You know, I think this research is incredibly important because we're just scratching the surface for this new crop. We're learning about what it can do and what it can't. And we hope to provide answers to growers looking to determine what varieties to grow, what practices they should use to grow them, and how they fit within our current production systems. The applications for this plant are so wide-ranging, from food for both humans and animals, and clothing, construction materials. And this represents a real opportunity to investigate the claims surrounding the adaptability and potential of hemp as a sustainable crop for this region.
Philip Alberti is a commercial agriculture educator for University of Illinois Extension. He's arguably the state's primary source of science-based information about raising hemp as a sustainable crop. We're celebrating National Farm City Week, highlighting some of the ways Extension is woven into the social and educational fabric connecting the rural and urban areas of America. We're now joined by Eric Snodgrass from Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible to discuss the weather forecast. Hi, Eric. Thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Let's start with the holiday, Thanksgiving, next week. I know that's a bit away. However, it looks like there may be some issues in the United States.
Yeah, that's right. So what's happening between now and then is we're going to watch what we call an omega block set up in the North Atlantic. So that's a part of something that we often term the negative phase of the North Atlantic Oscillation. That's just a bunch of phrases that we use in atmospheric sciences to say that the jet stream is going to go to Greenland. It's going to stay there. So what ends up happening is between now and then, most of the systems form over the Great Lakes and curl up into the Northeast, and we get colder weather. But now listen, when that colder weather comes through here, it pushes the boundary where we've got the mix of the cold and warm conditions south. And therefore, on Thanksgiving, I'm going to watch Texas closely because I think there could be what we call an Arklatex low. Arklatex, Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas. This is a low that comes out of that region, heads toward the Ohio River Valley, And now this is speculative because we're out there pretty far, but if it forms there, it could bring a chance for us to see some of the white stuff the weekend following Thanksgiving. Now, we're going to watch it carefully and see how this all takes shape. But this is something I'm watching right now. Other than that, we're overall on the drier side of things through the end of the month.
What does December into early January look like?
Yeah, so when we look out there at the month of December, the forecast is really dominated by La Nina. And what I mean by that is that we tend to see a lot of systems that run along the U.S.-Canada border. That does not tend to be an overly wet setup for us, but it does mean more frequent shots at some cooler air. On top of that, this is going to start to shove the MJO maybe away from phase five toward phase six and seven, which means that while we may frequently have more colder than warmer days, don't be surprised if we get some really nice, like, 2, 3, 4, 5 days of like decent, you know, warmer conditions tucked in there. But overall, this is going to be, I think, a bit quicker start to winter than a lot of people, well, at least a lot of us have experienced in the last few years. And it's certainly going to be one that I think is going to set us up. I mean, NOAA just released its new long-range update. It's got the Ohio River Valley set up to be very active, and that puts us on the backside of these systems as they start to form this winter.
Let's switch continents. What's the growing season been like so far in South America, particularly Brazil?
Yeah, there's been no struggle at all to get this monsoon going over Brazil. We've talked about that a lot lately. Where the concern now starts to show up is that we've been worried about the end of November through December being dry south. I'm talking far southern Brazil and Argentina. And just got some new model data yesterday afternoon on Thursday. And models have once again really favored dry conditions from now through at least mid-December in Argentina. And if that sticks, I'm going to be concerned about what that might mean toward the longer term drought situation in Argentina as we go through the middle of their growing season.
And finally, what about Europe? We haven't talked about it in some time.
Yeah, so the thing that I'm worried about with Europe is kind of the same setup that's giving us this big blocking pattern of the North Atlantic is and bringing colder air east in the United States, okay? I'm seeing the same thing happen in Europe, and that's very typical. When the North Atlantic gets blocked up like this, they go cold. And why we talk about that is we know that right now there is a on the demand side due to weather, there's going to be a lot of higher demand for heating across, well, not only New England, but old England, right? So over in Europe. And so I think we're going to have to just be watching for the cooler weather setting up in major population centers in the United States and in Europe as we go through the end of November and through December. That's what I wanted to kind of comment on about Europe right now.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Eric Snodgrass is with Nutrien Ag Solutions and joined us here on the Closing Market Report for this Friday afternoon. Stay with us. Commodity Week is up next.